Hello and welcome to our Kosher Classes monthly teleconference. I'm Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg and this is Dr. Avram Pollack, StarKay's president. As usual, we're here in Baltimore at the StarKay offices, and this is our monthly teleconference, the last Wednesday of every month. Today we're going to discuss Purim, wine on Purim or the rest of the year, and Shalach Manos, which is sending gifts on Purim from one person to the other. I want to make a change now to our next conference, which would be the last Wednesday of the next month, would fall out on Passover, on the second day of Passover. So being that we can't have a class then, we're going to pull it forward 2 weeks to March 17th, which the topic then will be all about Passover. So March 17th, Wednesday, we're going to have a class on the laws of Passover. But before we get to Passover, we have to get through Purim, which is coming up in a couple of days. And we asked Dr. Pollack to take out time from his schedule to come and speak to us about Purim and wine, and what's the word for a person who's an expert in wine? Connoisseur?
I believe the word would be an enophile. Which means eno referring to wine, and phile means a love of something.
Okay, he might be called also a drunk if he loves it too much.
A true enophile believes in moderation.
Okay.
And
all right. And just on that note, I want to make a disclaimer that the discussion about wine is for those who drink responsibly. We're not advocating getting drunk or such things. Everything, as Dr. Pollack said, has to be done in moderation with the proper attitude. And for those young people who are drinking, that's something that their parents need to be aware of and be very careful about. I just got an email this morning from the National Council of Young Israel, who we have an affiliation with, about that very topic, about drinking responsibly. So everybody is hopefully aware of those issues. So let's start with a question I want to ask you, Dr. Pollack, is that when, especially when I was growing up, when you had kosher wine, it was the sweet, maybe sticky, thick, you know, Passover wine that you had the four nights, the four cups, and that's what I think a lot of people have in their mind. That's what they view as kosher wine. I mean, was that true, and is it true today?
Actually, it is true, particularly in this country, going back to when Jewish immigrants first came, late 1800s, or mid to late 1800s, and certainly through the first half of the 1900s, there were no wine grapes available on the East Coast that were being grown. And it was not possible to make wine from anything but table grapes. And in New York State, upstate New York, there were many vineyards growing Concord grapes. And the kind of wine that one could possibly make from these grapes, technically is called wine, and certainly one can fulfill the obligation from the grape juice. Halachically, by Jewish law, it qualifies certainly as wine. But the wine that one produced from such grapes is so acidic that it is basically not drinkable. In order to overcome this, they figured out that if you lace the wine with sugar, it would be somewhat drinkable. And that's where this kosher sacramental wine became the norm. And simply because there was no other alternatives.
So they took the New York State grapes, is that right?
Correct.
And they, which wouldn't taste good if you don't add sugar, and they add sugar to it.
Well, these grapes would be excellent table grapes for eating.
Oh, for eating, but not for making wine. Okay, so if you're trying to make wine from those, you have to add a lot of sugar.
Right, and even then, even adding sugar, the result is this sweet, syrupy, sticky concoction that some people refer to as wine. But what you have to remember that going back to before the immigrants came to America, Many of them came from wine-growing areas, certainly the Italian Jews, the Spanish Jews, the French Jews, all through Western Europe, where wines were traditionally made. The kosher wines were pretty much identical to the non-kosher wines, as we find today, where kosher wines are being made literally all over the world in all the well-known wine-growing regions.
So now it rivals the non-kosher? The quality?
That's difficult to say. I don't know that a kosher wine rivals.
Without having tasted the non-kosher wines, how can we really compare them?
We can't compare them if one's only experience is with kosher wine, but certainly we can gather information from people who drink kosher wines who also drink the non-kosher wines. Kosher wines have won many medals and awards within their price range, and the type of grape, the varietal that one may make a wine from. But generally, you don't find the really high-end wines in the kosher market. There are some, few and far between, but there is not that much of a market for them that would lead producers to want to go out and invest in making a very high-end kosher wine.
Because the cost would be more than the market...
The cost of wine, even in the non-kosher, it's a very interesting thing how wines are priced. If you pay $100 for a bottle of wine, that certainly does not mean that wine is twice as good as a bottle costing $50, or four times as good as a wine costing $25. One can get an excellent wine for $25 that is very drinkable and quite satisfying. The price of a more expensive wine is generally due to the fact that it is a rare commodity and it becomes a collector's item, and people, a vineyard that has an excellent wine may only make 100 cases of this wine. So because of supply and demand, the price goes up, or the reputation of the manufacturer of the wine. With kosher wines, you really don't have that yet.
You don't have people collecting and looking out for a specific year or vintage?
There are some people who do go out of their way kosher wines.
What's the most expensive bottle of wine that you know of? Kosher wine?
Probably in the $200 to $300 range.
Uh-huh. So every glass is like $40?
Well, you're not talking about the average... wine drinker who's sitting down for dinner one night and is going to open a $300 bottle of wine, unless they're among the super wealthy. Generally, people who do spend so much for a bottle of wine are going to save it for a special occasion, an anniversary,
or especially a
wedding, perhaps a particular festive holiday meal, that type of thing.
I see. I just want to interrupt a second and... mentioned that we're here at the Starkey offices with Dr. Avram Pollack. My name is Rabbi Tzvi Goldberg. If you'd like to chat with us, you have a question about wine or Purim in general, if you're online with us at dimdim.com, which the password there is kosher, you can chat with us on the right side. If you are joining us by telephone, we'll give you a chance in a couple minutes to be able to ask a question to us. Okay, so let's get back to the differences a little bit between the kosher and the non-kosher wines. What is, in a nutshell, what makes a wine kosher? Let me just set up the question a little bit. I mean, grapes are kosher, and wine is just grapes and maybe some sugar, as we discussed. So what's non-kosher about wine?
Okay, that's an excellent question, particularly if one considers that produce, both fruits and vegetables, are typically kosher unless they're grown in the land of Israel, where there are special agricultural laws which one needs to consider, the tithing, and etc. However, we have to keep in mind that wine was not always a popular beverage as it is today. It was used... going back perhaps thousands of years, wine was certainly known, but it was used mostly for sacramental purposes. Mm-hmm. And very often these religious rites contained pagan practices. And as a result, the rabbis at that time decreed that only wine actually prepared by individuals observant can produce the wine. So, and since this was considered such an important restriction in the kosher dietary laws, it even came to that the mere touching of an individual who is not observant can render that wine undrinkable by an individual who is observant. Now, that certainly does not mean to say that a large wine manufacturer today has any intention of using that wine for sacramental or for any religious purposes. He's simply making a beverage and he's interested in selling his product, the best product he possibly can make to the customers. Mm-hmm. However, we still are bound by that restriction. So what happens today is that when one wants to make a kosher wine, they will generally go to a, if it's in France, they'll go to a well-known chateau or one that is not so well-known.
What's the chateau?
Chateau is a French,
French
wine manufacturer. Sometimes they have their own vineyard and they will have...
Is that the name of a particular place?
No. Chateau is a generic term for a winery. And... they will contract, the person who wants to sell kosher wine or manufacture kosher wine will contract with them. Generally, they stipulate that the wine has to be made from the identical grapes and the identical quality, the same way as the non-kosher.
That way they know
the
what they're
difference
getting.
Will be mm-hmm. is that at the time when the grapes are pressed and or crushed, at the early stages of making the wine, there are vinic supervisors themselves that are there, and they are the ones that start the pumps, so start the crushers, and anything that requires movement of the wine from one vessel to another is actually done by the person personally observant. At a subsequent stage, if they pasteurize the wine, that heat it to a certain degree, it no longer will have that restriction that becomes undrinkable if touched or somehow moved by a person who is not observant.
So that's mavushal wine.
Exactly.
Cooked wine.
The word mavushal, the translation means cooked, and it now can be served by non-Jewish waiters or anybody, or for that matter, even a Jewish person who is not personally observant can now handle that wine, pour the wine for you, and it is perfectly acceptable.
Right, so it's mavushal, M-E-V-U-S-H-A-A-L. A-L, that's usually the word you'll see on the bottle. So this group or team of rabbis goes to this chateau. Okay, how many are you talking about?
Depending on the how they make the wine, I personally did a number 28 team of 7-8 people there. Sometimes it's done with only 1-2 people, depending on how complicated it is, how large a production it is, how many different activities in the making of the wine need to be performed. Now, even after the wine is crushed and the it's in a tank fermenting, very often they will take samples from this wine, or they will take wine from the bottom of a large tank and pump it to the top, and this does make for a better quality wine. This will have to be done by that same individual or an observant person. It's most of the better wines, I would say most, but certainly not all, are actually non-mavushal. And it is for that reason why restaurants and caterers find it difficult to be able to use those type of wines, and most of the better non-mavushal wines are used by individuals for their own enjoyment. I want to tell you one interesting story, which was told to me by a well-known winemaker. He's actually a personal friend of mine, and he was making wine in some French chateau, and they then submitted the wine that was mavushal. They went through this pasteurization, and it was submitted at a local wine fair in France, mm-hmm. in the Bordeaux area. And it was very interesting because the kosher one, which was identical in every respect to the non-kosher, actually at that fair won a gold medal, while the non-kosher one submitted by the chateau itself won a silver medal. So go know. Even though most people are of the opinion that the mevushel process somewhat does make the wine, deteriorates the quality of the wine.
Maybe it was the holiness of the wine that convinced the judges.
Well,
it must be a blind test. It must be a
blind test. They are blind, you know, certainly wine.
Spirituality.
Well, you might say that, but I think that it's not a science. And tasting wine and the kinds of scores that a wine get can certainly vary a great deal. From one expert may rate a wine very high, and another expert may say the identical wine poured from the same bottle is awful.
Right. It could also be that there were differences a little bit in the grapes and where they made it, and even though it was
grapes supposedly came from the same vineyard, harvested on the same day, soil conditions were identical, the moisture, the season that it grew in, were everything identical, the same type of tanks. The winemaker is generally from the chateau. They are the people who control, and they determine when fermentation should stop. All the important details were identical, but just I guess one can conclude from this that sometimes the judges who make awards for wines are somewhat fickle, but that's to be expected. It's like anything else.
Right. It's not something done in a chemistry lab.
Yes, it's not an exact science.
Mm-hmm. Dev, can we give a chance to anybody who's joining us by phone if they want to ask a question? If you have a question, you can unmute yourself and ask. If you have any comments and you're with us by the dim-dim, please feel free to chat and we'll be happy to respond. Okay, so, I mean, that's... what else is there interesting about the wines? As you may have been able to tell, I don't drink much wine, even on Friday night and on... at the Kiddush, I'm a grape juice man.
Okay.
So, I recognize that you see in the Torah that many things are compared to
Absolutely.
Wine, and even the words of the Chachamim are compared to a good wine. So I recognize that I'm a little bit, maybe I should learn to appreciate it a little more.
I think that's the key word. You need to learn to appreciate. Somebody who has never, who's always had grape juice Friday night or the four cups on Passover and drinks their first glass of a dry red wine is not going to appreciate it right away.
Right.
There are just so many nuances and various things that one can enjoy and appreciate. The aroma of the wine, people have a great deal of fun comparing the wine to tastes that they've experienced, and that's why you'll find these descriptions. It has an earth type of taste, tobacco, the various spicy tastes, and so on. I once tasted a wine. The winemaker had actually sent me a bottle, and I was having a little fun with him, and he said, "What do I think?" And I said, "Well, I detect some notes of pickle juice," and he was highly offended.
Okay. So getting back to the point you made about the grape juice. So the difference between tell me if I'm correct, the difference between making grape juice and wine is that by the grape juice, they just basically crush the grapes, and maybe they filter it, and then they bottle it right away. They don't let it sit and ferment to become wine. Is that right?
That's correct. Wine is fermented grape juice, and basically the chemistry is as follows. There are sugars in the grape juice, and grapes naturally have certain yeasts growing on them, but it's just the old-time wines that were made relied on the natural yeasts, and therefore every batch of wine literally was unique in many ways. Today they try to control it, and they actually will add yeasts.
But how do they know that the yeast that's natural doesn't...
Because they add so much more that the preponderance is what they're going to be adding. The yeasts and this is what's called an aerobic process, it requires oxygen, will ferment that sugar present in the grape juice into alcohol. It's a simple chemical reaction and requires the enzymes produced by the yeast for this to happen. Once the wine is made and you have a certain, you reach a certain level of alcohol, it becomes self-inhibitory, which means that the yeast no longer can do that, because once the alcohol content, and this will depend on the strain of yeast, the various other factors, but typically anywhere between 12 to maybe 15-16%, the yeast will no longer be able to produce any more alcohol, even if there is sugar. A port wine, which has a higher alcoholic content, is one where they actually add alcohol to the wine to boost the strength of the alcohol content of the wine.
So you're saying naturally you can only get to about 15% alcohol.
Yeah,
so if you have, let's say, a 4% low alcohol wine, so are they stopping? They're stopping the process early.
Is that normally the way they would do that is stop the fermentation. And they can do that by controlling the temperature, refrigerating it, or add various things to it which will stop the fermentation. And generally, if there's residual sugar left, that's going to give you, make sure that the grape juice or the wine, this 4% wine, is going to be much sweeter.
Sweet.
When we talk about dry, we're talking about very literal residual sugar left over. But many of the table wines actually are sweet, where there is a great deal of residual sugar left over.
So
dessert wines, and that's certainly
so.
True.
The lower alcohol wines would tend to be sweeter than the higher alcohol percentage.
Generally, it depends again what the sugar content, uh-huh, as when you're starting off.
Uh-huh.
Any winemaker, before they even start the crushing process, they go out to the field every morning and they try to pick the grapes at the peak ripeness and so on, meaning when there is the most sugar, and they have a little refractometer where they crush they'll pick a grape off the vine, put it into this refractometer, and they can very accurately measure the sugar content of the grapes.
So that will give them a higher alcohol.
Generally, it will allow the fermentation to proceed more easily.
Uh-huh.
One other interesting thing about winemaking is that once the alcohol is formed, if bacteria should happen to get into the wine, then they will they can convert the alcohol that has been produced by the yeast into vinegar. And when wine goes bad, it turns vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think I made a mistake before. I said that the original process of making wine requires oxygen. Just the opposite. It's an anaerobic process, which is in the lacks oxygen. The
airtight.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. No oxygen present. The conversion of the alcohol to vinegar, that will require oxygen, and that's why when you open a barrel of wine, it can go bad very easily,
mm-hmm,
or you open the bottle of wine and let it sit around, it can very easily turn vinegary or just deteriorate quite fast.
I wanted to point out that Rav Moshe Heinemann, our rabbinic administrator, he said that the 4% wines can be used on Passover night at the Seder, and that's considered to be wine. Less than that, if you had a wine that had, I don't even know if they sell it, but let's say you had a wine with 2%, that would be considered grape juice, which you could also use, but it doesn't fulfill that extra additional requirement for wine on the Seder night. So I actually use 4% on the Seder night because I want to be awake and I don't want to get drunk.
Okay, and now what many people will also do is dilute their wine. Only can you dilute it with water to up to a certain extent, you have to know if there's some of the cheaper wines that are sold, and the traditional wines already are diluted with water, and one would need to know to what extent it's been diluted to know if you can add any more water to it. But certainly the wines which are 100% grape juice, one can dilute those to a certain extent.
Dilute the wine with grape juice.
Or with water,
that
cuts down the alcoholic content as well. Of course, it's not the same wine.
Right. Well, if you're what was the word you used? Enophile. Enophile. You're probably not going to be diluting your wine with grape juice.
That's true, but don't just remember that on Passover, when we drink
four cups
of wines, you're drinking four cups.
Right.
And
you're trying to stay alert.
Generally, wine is, when you're drinking it for pleasure, it's enjoyed with food, and the 4 cups of wine, the two are, as we know, the first 2 cups are before the meal, and one can certainly drink more wine during the meal, but that does not count as the 4 cup to fulfill the requirement of 4 cups. And the last 2 cups are after the meal, and by that time, even a true wine lover doesn't really drink wine for the pleasure. He's not doing it to fulfill the mitzvah requirements of drinking 4 wines.
Now, we should point out that it's not only a wine, you know, if the bottle says wine, that needs to be kosher, but there are other drinks as well that are wine-based that also need to be special kosher, like some brandies, right?
Well, particularly cognac, which is made from wine. It's basically a distilled wine, a particular type of grape, which is grown only in that region in France, in the Cognac region. You cannot use that name for grapes, even if it's the same variety of grapes. You cannot use that in any other area. But many brandies are wine-based as well. And they could only be kosher if you start off with a kosher wine.
Right. We also have, when we're talking about kosher, we have the issue of the Shemitah, the sabbatical year, that we are still seeing wines with the statement that they are harvested from grapes that were grown in Israel during the sabbatical year. And that's a whole another story, a whole another schmooze, a whole another discussion of how to deal with those. But one should be aware that if it says on it that it has kedushas shavias, the sanctity of the year of the sabbatical year, that one has to know how to properly drink that and to deal with it. We get a lot of questions about those.
That's correct.
Those
and
ones.
I believe the last two Shemitah cycles were 2001 and 2008, and there are still wines available from those vintage years, and those were Shemitah years.
Rick is saying that Carmel makes a brandy called 777,
yes,
which is made from grapes.
That's correct.
You're familiar with that.
Yes.
I think you're going to have a hard time finding something that Dr. Pollack has not heard of. What's the 777 stand for? What is that?
I'm not sure, but I'm sure there is some significance to it.
Okay. And the question here is William Grant's Scotch blended, I guess that's a blended, is that kosher? William Grant's.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that particular brand name, but let me just say very quickly something in general about Scotch whiskeys, or for that matter any other whiskey, if it has wine added to it. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was considered the most authoritative Jewish expert in Jewish law, has a ruling on this topic, and he basically states that even if wine had been added to whiskey, but if it was in small amounts, less than 1/6, it still is technically permitted. Now, this today we have many of this, particularly the single malt scotches, where they proudly display on the bottle and on their advertising that they're aged in
sherry
casks and so on. And so technically, according to the same ruling of Rabbi Feinstein, these single malt scotches would be permitted. However, it has become commonly accepted, and this is the Starkey policy, what the whiskeys that we allow our caterers, if they advertise the fact that they use a sherry cask, we say that they are very, this is provides character to this particular single malt scotch, and therefore it's something which is added for the taste, in a sense, the sherry, and we don't allow the caterers to serve that single malt scotch. But there are many, many excellent single malt scotches which don't mention the fact that they're aged in sherry casks. Some of them specifically say only oak casks or only casks used from bourbon whiskey. That's another type of whiskey made from mostly corn. And those would not be a problem. And I believe it is the Starkey policy to recommend such single malt scotches even without any kosher certification.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We do have the liquor list online at star-k.org. You click on Kosher Consumer and then Latest Lists, and you can see all the different liquors and liqueurs that are acceptable according to the Starkey opinion. I know that's a very popular list that people take off our site. Here's a question. Do you have time for a question?
Yes.
Okay. For Pesach, how much can one dilute a cup of wine? Okay, so we touched on that before. Well, if you're diluting it with grape juice and you still want it to be considered
right. Wine,
so you could dilute it down to the 4%. So if you had an 8% alcoholic wine and you added half grape juice, it would be now 4% and still be considered
okay. Wine. But technically, what you're saying
is... Oh, yes, you dilute it with water.
If you dilute it with water, I believe it is still called wine, even if you dilute it up to six times with water. I believe that's the technical limit.
But it still has to taste like
wine.
It would have to look like wine,
and if one wants to also have this added aspect, which is that it has an alcoholic content of 4%, and that's to symbolize the cheirus component of the wine we drink at the Seder. Cheirus means freedom, and because we were freed as slaves from Egypt, that is the symbolism behind the four cups of wine. So people want to drink real wine. But certainly if somebody is ill, a child, or for whatever reason, drinking alcohol is going to put them to sleep at the Seder, they can drink grape juice.
Or you can drink wine,
which is diluted, I believe, up to six times with water.
It's 3% kal wine kosher for the four kosas. So there's a wine that has only 3% alcohol. Can you use it for the four cups on Passover? Well, based on what we're saying, yes, yeah. You can use it, but it doesn't have that.
And it could be. You know, this 4% alcohol is not a magical number; it's not carved in stone.
Mm-hmm.
And it could that may be Rabbi Heinemann, and certainly the policy of the Star K that is the number. But it's possible that other halachic authorities have ruled that even a 3% would technically qualify as an alcoholic beverage and to satisfy that component. But we certainly follow our rabbinic administrator, and therefore we tell people the 4% limit.
I thought that 4% was also the legal bottom where you could call something wine. So I'm interested to hear that there is a 3% wine. Is that really called? Well, maybe it's called like a wine cooler or something. I think it may have a different name. So if we have here someone Teitelbaum, he's saying there's a three. He says it's called Kedem Kal. But I'd be curious whether or not it's called a wine or it's just a wine cooler.
It could be that the certifying authorities of Kedem Wine,
right?
And it would probably say on the bottle,
right,
if it's acceptable for the four cups.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not familiar with that.
He said someone else said it's 3.5%. Okay, so we're getting there.
Yeah.
Maybe it really is a wine. Okay, is there anything else that we didn't really get a chance to talk too much about the Mishloach Manos issue? I guess we tried to bite off more than we could chew, excuse the pun. But that's coming up on Purim on Sunday, and people do also give wine. It is a relevant topic because people give wine many times as one of the two food items that they give to their friends. Many times it's a bottle of wine. Of course, if you're going to give Dr. Pollock Shalach Manos, then you want to make sure that you call me before to make sure whether or not it's something that he would approve or appreciate.
I certainly think that the whole concept of Mishloach Manos is to gladden the hearts of the recipients, and therefore one should tailor their Shalach Manos to who it is. If you're giving something to children, you know, certainly one should give them what they consider a treat.
Right.
You know, if one gives an adult, you know, a couple of jelly beans or a bag of potato chips, mm-hmm. I don't know that that's necessarily in the spirit of real Shachmanas. So certainly, if you want to give wine, by all means, if somebody who appreciates wine, don't give it to children, don't give it to somebody who doesn't appreciate it, or if they do really like wine, you might want to find out something about their preferences. Most people, even if they don't really like wine, will find a white wine very acceptable, and it's something that good white wine can almost all people enjoy, and that's simply because it's not as dry, doesn't have the same level of tannins.
Why is white wine not as dry as the
Typically because of the way they make
sugar?
A white wine. Not necessarily. No, there are many totally dry white wines as well. But one of the big differences between a white wine is the way they control the fermentation, the amount of tannins. Tannins are when you have a red wine which makes your mouth pucker and you feel it, that's usually due to the tannins. Certainly the amount of acid in the wine and the amount of tannins, this is what all combine in very different subtle ways to give the individual quality to a particular wine.
I just want to ask, we do have Star K wines. Well, this is not an advertisement, but just to let everybody know, there are Star K wines. You're familiar with those brands, right?
We have some wines that are available with the Star K certification. Some of these wines are under the Mayor Halpern name, and there's about 7 or 8 different wines. I believe they have a champagne as well.
Do they have to get your taste approval before they get the Star K?
No, they have to be kosher.
Have to be kosher, okay. And so we take care of that. But we don't look into the taste, as we don't with any of our food products. I'm just kidding you. Are you now permitted? Well, here, 1 second. Here's a question: is there a mitzvah to drink wine by the Seuda? Yehuda is asking: is there a requirement to drink wine on Purim day at the meal at the festive meal?
That's a loaded question for reasons, and many of the later day certainly a question that the decisors of Jewish law discuss, and it does say the famous Talmud saying that a person should drink to this state of intoxication where he no longer is aware of the difference between blessed be Mordechai and cursed be Haman. Now, what does that mean? I don't believe that any halachic authority is recommending that people get drunk. That's certainly not in the spirit of Purim, and certainly in recent years there have been so many tragic incidents, particularly among our youth, where people have gotten drunk on Purim and then when it drove a car, and just terrible, terrible tragedies. It's becoming more and more popular in the yeshivas today where they just banning the drinking of wine. I have a grandson who's in a yeshiva in Boston, and I was just speaking to him the other night, and he told me that boys were told absolutely no alcohol is going to be permitted. And certainly commend the yeshivas for taking this. But getting back to the question of what degree one needs to drink, I think that one should consult their own rabbi, because there are so many different ways that this question can be answered. One can drink wine and perhaps it will make them a little drowsy and then they take a nap. I believe most poskim certainly feel that this is more in the spirit of fulfilling that obligation.
Right. There's certainly no obligation to drink.
But remember, wine is typically the type of drink, and throughout our literature, our halachic literature, our agadic literature, it's even a pasuk that wine gladdens the heart of man. And the real reason for drinking wine is this is what gives us that simcha which we are required to have on the day of Purim.
Okay, on that note, Dr. Pollack, I think we will call it the end of this program. I want to thank everyone for joining us here at kosherclasses.org, and as a reminder, the next session will not be on the last Wednesday of the month as it usually is, because that falls out on Passover, but it will be March 17th, about 2 weeks before Passover, on Wednesday at noon, and we'll discuss Passover issues and give you a chance to ask your questions over here directly to prepare for Passover. These sessions are recorded, and they are available at kosherclasses.org under podcasts, so you can see this show in a couple days, and the previous. Zev is laughing because it all depends on when he's able to get around to putting it up, but it usually is within a couple days, and then the last show is up there and the previous ones. If you have any questions during the year, you can call us at 410-484-4110. Again, I want to thank everyone for joining us, and have a very, very happy Purim.
Thank you, Dr. Goldberg.
Thank you, Dr. Pollack, for coming. Have a good day.